I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about a person who is very familiar to, of course, all Americans, to listeners of this podcast, people who care about American history, American politics, and that's President Ronald Reagan. We've talked a lot about him on this podcast, but I don't think we ever talked about him with someone who knew him from the inside, who was there with Reagan in the White House. And learned from Reagan some important lessons on American life and politics for today. Joined for the conversation about inside the Reagan White House with Ambassador Frank Lavin. Ambassador Lavin was political director in the Reagan White House, also served as Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade for George Bush, the first presidency, and then, of course, served as ambassador to Singapore for President George W. Bush. So Ambassador Lavin has had a very long and distinguished career in public service, and of course also served as a lieutenant commander in the Naval Reserves. And we thank you for your service in the Navy, Ambassador Lavin.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff, for having me on. It's fun to visit with you, and it's always great to talk about American history and Ronald Reagan. So thanks a lot for this interview.
In the book, You address what it's like to be on the inside in the Reagan White House. So you had a privileged position that not a lot of folks get a chance to have, to see the workings of the White House and of the presidency. As you know, there are a lot of different verdicts on Ronald Reagan. There certainly were a lot of takes on Reagan at the time in the 1980s. People said, even saw these on things like Saturday Night Live skits. On the one hand, Reagan is a bumbler who speaks well but really has no coherent ideas or thoughts. On the other hand, you have people say, no, he's full of thoughts. He's a hard right ideologue. And then you have other people who say the verdict of history is that he is much more of a statesman than people appreciated at the time, perhaps in the 1980s. You had a chance to see Reagan from the inside. Where do you fall in this judgment of Ronald Reagan and his presidency?
Yeah, that's a great, and it's almost a permanent question. And by the way, we've had other presidents like Harry Truman, and I would say even Abraham Lincoln, that at the time of their service suffered enormous criticism and questions. Was Abraham Lincoln up to the job? And he's kind of throwing the whole thing away, and is Harry Truman? So it's not uncomfortable. I think it's a healthy attribute of a democracy that we're willing to have these questions. But one great advantage we also enjoy is that over the passage of time, that immediate, typically sort of very ideological judgment fades a bit, and people then can take a more balanced view. Was Harry Truman more or less trying to do the right thing? Even if you didn't think at the time he was, now a few decades later, can we say, did people need to push back against Stalin? Was working with European allies constructive or not? I would offer the same courtesy to Ronald Reagan. I'd say in the moment, it's almost a purely ideological decision, as it is in the moment with anybody. If you more or less like what Barack Obama was trying to do, you more or less say, boy, he did a good job, or I really like him. And the opposite, if you had problems with Barack Obama. But I would say that's where we were with Ronald Reagan. If you really thought efforts to cut the federal budget were a bad idea, you said, boy, Reagan's bad. If you thought trying to change the status quo internationally and trying to put pressure on Moscow was bad, you'd say Reagan's really bad. Now, a few decades later, I think people will say, you know, there's no question at all that communism was a real blight, not just economically, not just in human rights, but was a direct threat to America. And people who pushed back against that were actually the good guys. So we give Reagan credit for leadership in making that transformation. I think most people would also say that protecting and encouraging economic growth, supporting prosperity is a huge, important goal for U.S. leadership, and Reagan did a good job on those metrics as well. So at least on those two very important pillars of his presidency, I think most people tend to give him positive views, certainly my view. And to you, the other part of your question, if I may, Jeff, he was very serious about ideas. He had a very folksy demeanor, a genial demeanor, almost a corny sense of humor that we in Ohio are very familiar with. But I think as a result of all of that, people give him less credit than he deserves. He loved reading. He liked ideas. He liked writing out his own speeches or drafts of it or so forth. He had a great team of speech writers, but he also played an active role in realizing that communications is a form of leadership. Communication is a form of management. And this was a very important tool, not just as president, but even before when he's helping espouse conservative viewpoints and so forth. But this was his real strength, and he cultivated that capability. So I give him credit on that score as well.
So, you, of course, your book is called Inside the Reagan White House, a front row seat to presidential leadership with lessons for today. All right. Take us then behind the myth of Ronald Reagan, the historical person, to the Ronald Reagan that you experienced inside the White House. What was he like?
Sure. I think he was an incredibly genial guy, but he also had a sort of wall around him, meaning I thought his view of his staff, his team, and even outsiders was a friendly approach is always the best approach. But I think he actually had very few actual friends. So he was his wife had a great, Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan had a great relationship, but he did not have a natural group of people beyond that kitchen cabinet that started with him in California. So there was sort of a little loneliness at the top, if you will. But what you saw in person was how it was in real life, meaning fundamentally a genial person, fundamentally a person said, not just as a courtesy, but also as a consensus building tool, starting with a smile and outreach is always the best way to start.
How did he operate the White House? Was he a hands-on manager? Jimmy Carter, for example, had been criticized for being a micromanager of the White House. How did the White House operate under Reagan?
I give you two general thoughts on this. One is the two attributes of leadership that Ronald Reagan respected and governed on was you have to be able to articulate a vision, and then you have to create a consensus for action. If you're not in government, and if you're just sort of a policy spokesman or a social media person, then simply the first category is okay. You're just articulating a vision. This is what America needs to do. Fine. But if you're in government, if you're in the White House, you need to be able to say, we've got to get a bill through Congress or a budget approved or something else to enable these ideas to take form. So it doesn't do you any good just to be in the first space and say, here's where I want America to go, if you can't also occupy in the second space. So you had this twin goals, if I may say it that way, of having a sense of goals, of a sense of where you want to take America, and also saying we got at some point to have a piece of paper that's signed and we have 51%. And that, to my mind, to answer more specifically the question of management, was that were the dual roles of Jim Baker and Ed Meese. Ed Meese was a longtime Reagan backer, longtime confidant friend, and really internalized the Reagan message and was always the advocate for that. And you can call that group the true believers. The other group are more the pragmatist, and Jim Baker sort of represented or led that instinct, if you will, to say, regardless of what you think and where you want America to go, we've got to do something. Don't forget, Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House. So you have real opposition from Congress, meaning there's still a significant body in Congress and the congressional Democrats that are centrist or even right of center, and you need to be able to reach them and work with them. Speaking to the nation was part of that. Cajoling or working with those conservative Democrats is part of it, but you had to do your outreach and you had to get something off the table at the end of the day, or else you're just a sort of a social media person and you're not really governing the country.
Well, it is remarkable how many significant accomplishments the Reagan administration had, including legislative accomplishments, thinking about things like the tax cuts early on, the defense buildup, all of which Reagan said he was going to do. The Reagan White House, how did it work in its relations with Congress? Because presidents over the years, as you know, have had some very vexed relationships with Congress, even presidents of their own party, with members of their own party in Congress.
Look, Reagan took a inclusivity point of view toward political opposition, meaning don't have a chip on your shoulder if somebody's against you. Because if somebody's with you 30% of the time, maybe you can get that up to 40%. If somebody's with you 70% of the time, maybe you get it to 80%. But you're always sort of conducting outreach. You're always having a conversation. You're always acting in good faith. Maybe the other side isn't always acting in good faith, but you've got to sort of lead through positivity, and you've got to be able to count your numbers too. So that first effort at tax cuts was a 33% tax cut is what he wanted. That didn't work. Then he said 30%, that didn't work, but he got 25%. So the point is, as soon as he kept trimming a little bit, he got almost all of what he wanted, but he didn't get 100%. And if you didn't have that ability to have that conversation with people who were neutral or maybe even unexcited about what you were doing, you wouldn't have gotten a majority for that 25%. And by the way, we saw that same thing with the arms buildup, that in general, there was a consensus across the political spectrum that we were underweight and the Soviets were pretty aggressive and we needed to find ways to push back. But that's about as far as that consensus went. And when Reagan said we need this weapon system, that weapon system, or do this or that, there'd be enormous opposition to any specific idea. So it was sort of people like the Reagan themes or like the Reagan ideas, but they don't want to pay for it or don't want to do anything about it, right? So to say, yeah, but if you don't do something about it, then you're not going to get any value out of those actions. And remember, Reagan changed the existing consensus on the Cold War through his own vision, his own beliefs. The existing consensus, which was bipartisan, Jeff, when he came into office, was we are unfortunately trapped in this long-term or permanent stalemate with Moscow, that these guys are going to be here forever and they're nuclear armed and they have clientele and there's nothing we can do about it. And Reagan said the Soviet system is bankrupt. Moscow is a lot more ricketier than it appears, and we can go toe-to-toe with them, and we can engage in increasing our hard power, strengthen our military. We can engage in using technology. We can engage in global messaging and let people from neutral countries or third world say that democracy is going to give you better outcomes and also enjoys the higher moral ground, that societies are better off and human beings are better off in a democratic society than they are in a Soviet society. So if you message that the right way, you can take people with you.
Yeah, that's really one of the remarkable things to me about Reagan is, as you say, the Cold War consensus. Certainly in the 70s, there was a big movement in detente, right? Let's have friendly relations with the Soviets and let's not provoke them and let's sort of try to come together. And then you have the old Truman, perhaps, doctrine of containment. You know, as you say, we have to live with the Soviet Union, but we should contain them. And then you had what people, at least during the Reagan administration, would call rollback. It's not enough to live with contained communism. Yeah. We have to roll it back.
Right.
Was that a product of Reagan's own thinking, or was that the people around him?
Well, I think it very much was Reagan's thinking. By the way, he wasn't exclusive in that. I mean, but it was definitely a minority opinion. But there was Committee on the Present Danger and Committee for the Free World. There were sort of conservative movement groups in the 1970s who were kind of appalled at Jimmy Carter's mismanagement of foreign policy. And that resulted in folks saying, look, the Soviet Union is bad news. These fellows are predatory and they're dangerous and it is harmful to our interests, even if it takes place in a remote part of the third world. We don't have any maybe direct interest there, but every time they gain ground, we're losing ground. And that was, I thought, a reasonable supposition. And Reagan very much subscribed to that point of view. And he said, I'm going to take America down a path where we are going to push back against the Soviets. Rollback was the more commonly used term. You're right, Jeff.
Of course, then it's what's interesting also is then you have Ronald Reagan, and you're there in the White House during some of this time where a new Soviet leader arises, Mikhail Gorbachev.
Right.
And then, as you talk about in the book, you have the situation with Gorbachev and, of course, the Reykjavik summit and Reagan's apparent movement away from a hardline position on the Soviet Union, or at least that's what some people, perhaps on his right, accused him of. What was it like to be in the White House at that time when Reagan begins to make overtures and establish a relationship with Gorbachev?
Yeah. Yeah, by the way, I think at least some of that premise you articulated is valid, meaning Reagan was not 100% stick, no carrot. But he'd say, I want to talk, meaning he wasn't just belligerent toward the Soviets. He did want to engage. But I think his wisdom was that it only makes sense to have the carrot if you also have the stick. And you might want to start with the stick. You might want to put economic pressure on them, put that communications pressure on them, build up our military. Then you can have a conversation. And you're on even footing or maybe even better footing than they are. But simply saying, I don't want problems with the Soviet Union, so I'm going to reach out to them and see if we can solve our differences, I think is a disaster. I think it's you're imputing good faith on the other party. Charles Krauthammer always called that the broken telephone theory of diplomacy, that the reason we have these problems is because the telephone's broken. So if we just sit down, we can work out our problems. But people have tried that with Cuba. People have tried that with North Korea. The telephone's not broken. These folks represent a bad regime that is hostile to U.S. Security. So we're better off dealing with a position of strength. Then we can have a conversation. And that's exactly what happened in Reykjavik. And this was Gorbachev's last grab, if you will, last effort to stop the SDI program, which is the key tech innovation of that era, the Strategic Defense Initiative, that we can use satellite to stop incoming Russian missiles. Well, if you can do that, you're devaluing or eliminating that Russian threat. And the only thing they've sort of done successfully in 70 years is build out that strike capability, that nuclear capability. And if you take that away from them, they don't have a lot many cards to play. So this was Gorbachev's last effort to try to get the U.S. to back away from that program, which Reagan would not do, even at the ultimate outcome of walking away from the table, and there was no clear victory or benefit out of Reykjavik. But as I say in the book, sometimes no is the right answer. Sometimes walking away from the table gets you to a better outcome than trying to accommodate or trying to split the difference doesn't always get you the best answer.
Inside the White House in times like that, what are the fights that are taking place? What are the struggles? You talk a little bit about this in the book, of course. Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about the kind of pressures that a president faces.
But I think you're right. It's an open conversation about where are we trying to go and how are we trying to get there and where do we draw the line. Fair enough, because some of this is ambiguous. At some point, though, somebody's got to blow the whistle on the play and say the play's over. We've got to move this ahead. But for example, one of the key decisions that has to be made by any presidency, and this is an example of leadership, is what we are not going to do. To say any presidency can only encompass a half dozen issues or initiatives at most, and anything else is a distraction. So we support, 100 different issues, but we're really going to allocate our time against these five or six main goals. Everything else is sort of symbolic. It might be important. It might be really nice to host the winning sports champion in the White House after their victory. That is a nice thing to do. You have to say that is purely symbolic. So let's do it. Let's get some goodwill out of it. But let's move back then to our issues and what we're trying to do to make America a better place.
In the Reagan White House and at that time, the agenda for picking those sort of five or six main goals, is that coming from Ronald Reagan?
I think it is. Here's the great advantage of Ronald Reagan. This guy was a national political figure for at least 16 years. I mean, he had a very successful run and came very close to winning in 76 against an incumbent president, against Gerald Ford, but it was a national campaign. He had a brief run that was maybe more symbolic than anything else in 68. And then he gave this national Barry Goldwater address in 1964. So at least for those 16 years, he was a national political figure with radio addresses, with newspaper columns, and with writing books, and giving public speeches. So people knew where he stood. And I would say he managed through that communications channel. And also, by doing it for so long, it allowed him to build the team. So key people in the Reagan White House came from that process. Marty Anderson, the Council of Economic Advisors, Dick Allen, who was his national security advisor, all of them were campaign advisors who he had known for years. So that gave a terrific amount of cohesion to his outcomes, and everybody sort of knew where he stood. So you didn't have to sit down. What Ronald Reagan didn't do was sort of sit down at a staff meeting with 20 people saying, what are you working on this week? What are you working on this week? What are you working on the week? So that's not presidential leadership. Now, somebody has to do it, and it typically fell to Jim Baker to have the sort of management. But since Reagan's public record was so well known and so established, everybody had their lighthouse in front of them about where the beacon was and how they needed to head in a certain direction.
And of course, he was well known for having that vision that he had developed over years. And as you say, much more of a reader and a thinker than at least his opponents at the time gave him credit for. But even his opponents agreed Ronald Reagan was a great communicator. In fact, the great communicator, as he was called.
Well, also, he had this view, and I think this comes from Hollywood, his time as a movie actor and a radio sportscaster before that. Meaning what you're trying to do in communications is take people with you. You're not there to denigrate your opponent. You're not there to insult people. You're trying to be as inviting as possible to your audience, which is part of just being polite. But also, I think it's smart marketing. There's a reason he's telling a joke, not just to sort of lighten the mood, but to say, I want people to feel comfortable with me. And I don't want them to think of me as sort of the mean Sunday school teacher. I want them to think of me as sort of collegial or friend with some ideas. And I want you to listen to my ideas and let's all think about where they might take America. So he had a very modest approach, but boy, I think was enormously successful in trying to build as big a majority as he could for his initiatives.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
Yeah, I'm struck, for example, by in the 1984 presidential election during a debate with Walter Mondale, he tells a joke and Mondale himself laughs at it.
Yeah, it was a pretty good joke. By the way, back to 84, and I think all of his campaigns, he would never even mention his opponents by name. That was considered rude. So he would say my opponent, or he'd say to the Democratic Party or the other party. So he would know who you're referring to, but he wasn't trying to attack anybody personally. He was just trying to advocate his views. And you're right, he had a very unassuming demeanor, and he had a pretty thick skin too, because you know people are going to say you're not very bright, you know, that people want the technocrat. If you want Al Gore for president, well, Al Gore will come across maybe as smarter than Reagan. Well, Reagan was no dummy, and Reagan had moments of spontaneity or cleverness that even I'm working with him, and you know, all of a sudden he jumps in and changes the conversation. That was pretty good. I mean, this guy's quick on his feet. He's got an agility to him that you sometimes miss, because the rap on him was, well, he's reading cue cards and he's not really thinking about this stuff. But he was very good in small group meetings, very good at shaping that consensus. And I looked at, when I was at the NSC, a lot of these one-on-one meetings with Margaret Thatcher, with Mitterrand, with the Japanese prime minister, I mean, he was very good at connecting with them. And to your point about management, what we would always do as a lead up is we'd start with a meeting with Ronald Reagan, maybe a month before the meeting, and say, you are having lunch with François Mitterrand, the president of France, NATO ally, but a socialist. What needs to come out of this meeting for us to be happy, for the meeting to be successful? And the second question is, well, what does he want? He's not here as a tourist. He's here because he's running his government as well. And he wants something as well. So what is he going to ask for? Then you start the staff level conversations. You go to the French embassy, the French foreign minister, and say, here's what we're looking at. What are you guys looking at? And we, you know, this would be a series of meetings, because what you want is to try to get this as advanced as possible, so when the two presidents sit down, you can close the deal or close the sale, or at least know what's not going to happen. But what you don't want to have happen is have one person say to the other, well, what brings you to town? What's on your mind? And have it just float at that time. That's a waste of everybody's time. So Reagan was very diligent in that court of that sort of logical follow-through of what are we trying to get. Being foreign policy and diplomacy was a means to an end. Where are we trying to take America? How can France help fit into that picture? And what do we have to do or say to work with these fellows so that we're happy and they're happy?
And what about his personal relationship? I mean, it's impressive that he would be sort of that kind of preparations behind the scenes to make sure those kind of meetings with a foreign leader, a Mitterrand or a Thatcher, goes how it should go. What about his personal relationships with some of those foreign leaders? I'm thinking, for example, of what people have said, at least, was a warm friendship with Margaret Thatcher.
That was the best personal chemistry I saw. There was respect for Helmut Kohl. There was respect for François Mitterrand. There's always respect for Japan. But I have to say, there was not personal chemistry. And for whatever set of reasons, He viewed Margaret Thatcher more as a peer, although Helmut Kohl in Germany was from the right of center political party, the Christian Democrat Union, but he didn't have that. Now there's a language gap there because Helmut Kohl really didn't speak any English, and Margaret Thatcher was very forceful at English, as we all know. Also, there's this great sort of cultural political similarity in that both of them were political outsiders to their own party's establishment, and both of them, if you will, replaced an establishment leader. Margaret Thatcher replaces Ted Heath, and Ronald Reagan, after the Ford defeat, goes on to lead the Republican Party. So they had similarities of sort of anti-establishment or contrarians. They both very much believed in hard power, the need for defense buildups. This is during the Falklands War, where Argentina grabs this British territory, the Falkland Islands, and Margaret Thatcher said, we're going to take this back, and Reagan was 100% supportive of that. Don't let people grab territory, and don't be afraid to push back if they push you. And it is, you are incentivizing aggressors if you just stand still while somebody grabs territory. You are rewarding the predator, so don't do that.
You saw so much of Reagan in the White House on so many different occasions. You saw high, you saw low moments, you saw high moments. Yeah. How was Reagan in tough times?
Yeah, I got to say that I think this is maybe a product of his time growing up in the Great Depression. He had a very modest background, if not poverty, borderline, poverty adjacent, not a lot of money. And his father, sad to say, was a chronically unemployed and had a severe drinking problem as well. So it was a household without a lot of security and no real material security. But there was, I think, joy there nonetheless. His parents loved him, and he benefited from that household despite that deprivation. But I think that message he took away from that is you've got to always be an optimist. There's this great quote by their son, their first son, Michael Reagan. And he said, you know what, my dad was always the optimist. My mom is always the skeptic. So if you look at, you know, that question, we all know, is the glass half empty or half full? Dad would always say the glass is half full, always be optimistic. Mom would always say, who stole that half glass of water from my dad? So mom was always skeptical or you know, a bit protective of Ron Reagan. But Ronald Reagan himself was always the optimist.
And his best moments, when in your mind were some of Reagan's best moments as president in the White House?
You know, there was a human side to him that responded to other people's human problems or human successes. And it was really telling to me that this fellow was not, he was serious about policy, but he wasn't exclusively a policy animal. Policy is a means to an end. It helps your country get to a better place. And I remember, Jeff, one incident from the very last campaign swing as president. It's election day, and he gives two talks in California to carry this is 88. This is Vice President George Bush running against Michael Dukakis. Reagan's 100% committed to his own vice president. He gives two speeches in California, flies back to the White House, flies back to the lawn. And typically when the president arrives at the White House lawn, staff members come out to greet him with maybe hand-painted signs. And they're, you know, as you can imagine at this moment, they're kind of predictable supportive signs. Win one for the Gipper, four more years, Reagan, Hart, Bush, or you know, what you'd expect. And he always would go over and talk to people at the rope line who were doing that just to have a few words of thanks to them for coming out. But interestingly, that time, that last day, the sign that he went over to was not a political sign or a political support. A kid who was an intern in my office held up a sign that said, will you be my grandpa? And he went over to that guy to talk to that guy. And I was very taken by that because it was to me, it was a very strong statement of Reagan, of humanity being more important than political victory. And it was clear when somebody holds up a sign like that, what that guy is really saying is, look, I've got trouble in my life. I've got a hole or something in my life that's missing, and maybe you can help fill it. And Reagan knows, we all know, well, you can't replace him, but you can give him a few minutes of kindness, and you can lift the kid up. So I found that very moving.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. And it struck me that that same kind of humanity is revealed in a lot of Reagan's letters that he wrote to people, including while he was president. It's really remarkable I had no idea that he was such a dedicated letter writer and such a dedicated connecting to the American people that way.
Yeah, there was one time when he was a Hollywood actor and he's taking the train to shoot, and the train is pulled into a siding for whatever, you know, at the station, it's on hold for 10 minutes or whatever, or they switch tracks. And he's with somebody, it might have been Ray Milland, he's with another actor. And some people on the platform say, that's Ronald Reagan. And they run over for autographs and for chatting, and loved your last movie, and he's talking away. And after they leave, the other fellow, the other actor says, those people really interfere with your business, don't they? And to which Ronald Reagan says, those people are our business. I mean, allowing fans to like us is a very important part of our job. And if we hold ourselves away from people or think we're above people, we're not doing our job. So, you know, that was great discipline and great self-awareness on his part.
Another thing that struck me reading some of his letters is he has several talking about his religious faith.
Yes.
And Reagan was perhaps, in comparison to Jimmy Carter, not the most publicly religious person. Yes. Can you talk a little bit about, from the inside, how you saw Reagan's religious faith?
I do think it anchored him. I think, and you're right, by the way, in terms of like going to services and quoting Bible verses, I agree. Carter's probably stronger in those sort of outward manifestations of religion. But in terms of anchoring him and his self-assuredness and his willingness to engage with other humans, I think religion was absolutely central to his identity. And the lesson there is love thy neighbor. Love thy neighbor. You should not speak ill of other people. You shouldn't denigrate other people. You should treat everybody with respect. And if people, you know, internalize that core lesson from religious teaching, we'd have a better society. So there's no doubt that that shaped his behavior. And it gave him a sense of calm as well. I think he deal with setbacks. You know, he loses this 76 race against Gerald Ford. By the way, in the primary system in 1976, Reagan actually receives more votes than Gerald Ford. But they're in the wrong place, so to speak, you know, sort of an electoral college setup where you could really sweep right. the state. And then so, but it had to be enormously frustrating to him to say, actually, I sort of won this thing, but it wasn't allocated the right way. So, but the point is, there's no bitterness to this guy. There's no, you know, chip on his shoulder or say, I'm going to really settle. In fact, he was talking about 4 years later about making Ford his vice president before he went to George H.W. Bush. So there was not ill will. And I think he said, look, that's the wrong way to go through life. You're going to have setbacks. There's going to be twists and turns. There's going to be things you don't like. And you can't anchor yourself on that bad news. What you need to do is focus on some good news. So that's a great life lesson.
Of course, one of the things that you do in your book is lay out presidential leadership with lessons for today.
Yeah.
What are some of the most important lessons that you learned from being with Ronald Reagan?
Well, I would say both in security policy and in trade policy, friends are useful, friends are important, and friends help us have a better life. So I would say we had this World War II architecture that really shocked, you know, Pearl Harbor, the calamity of World War II really shaped a lot of Reagan's approach to international affairs. And the Cold War, in some ways, was an extension of the same logic that alliances are enormously helpful, hard power matters, messaging matters a lot. He liked FDR and FDR's fireside chats. He voted for Franklin Roosevelt all four times, although then he subsequently moved to the right, but he respected that outreach activity that FDR took. So all of those points of World War II architecture, Cold War architecture, he adhered to throughout his presidency. And by the way, this is even knowing that some friends are going to underperform or some friends are going to be overly demanding. Or, you know, we know that in our personal lives. That's the nature of human beings. But what really matters is how much can you cultivate and how much goodwill and support can you get from like-minded nations. If we're going to have this global competition against the Soviets, we want as many friends as possible, just like we had a global competition against Hitler in Japan. We wanted as many friends as possible. So that was his view of alliance management. And by the way, same thing on trade, that tariffs are a tax, and lower tariffs mean lower taxes means more prosperity.
And I'm also struck by, of course, those policy views. And also, as you know, the courage that Reagan had to articulate those views, even when they were not fashionable, And even sometimes I'm thinking, for example, of the Brandenburg Gate speech.
Yeah.
In what, 1987, yeah. When people are saying, don't say those things.
Right. And by the way, that is a great example. We talked a few minutes ago about two sort of tribes in the Reagan's management, the more true believers, the more pragmatists. But that was a terrific example to my mind of where the true believers really had the right approach to say, if you're trying to change the Soviets, putting them on their back foot, and calling them out for some of their misdeeds is a useful building block. It's not that we want to create scorn or create ill will, but we do want to hold them accountable. And remember, Gorbachev comes into office. He is the first time in some 40-some years that the Soviet leader is younger than the American leader. Also, Gorbachev, unlike his immediate predecessors, but Brezhnev, who were sort of aged, slow-moving, you know, career functionaries, Gorbachev is a little light-footed. He can smile. He can talk with people on the street. So he's a little more of a media age person, and it looked like a different kind of Soviet leader. He at least could position himself that way. So Reagan called his bluff to say, here's a question, Mr. Gorbachev, if you really believe it's a new era and you want better relations, why don't you tear down that wall? So it's quite a challenge to these guys. And Gorbachev couldn't perform. I mean, it was only with the collapse of the Soviet Union that the wall came down. But it was odd to have a modern country, so to speak, have border controls that won't let people leave, and for Gorbachev to be able to say, but we're every bit as good, as important, as compassionate as you guys, to say, well, apparently you're not. Apparently you're not, because you're ignoring simple human freedoms, like freedom to travel or educate or do business in other countries.
The fact that Ronald Reagan would say, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, did that surprise you from the Reagan that you knew?
Well, I welcomed it. I'm trying to think of my mood at the time, because, you know, Reagan had this capacity to say what we've been doing or the way we've been approaching this isn't the right way or the best way, and we need to change it. And I get that. I absolutely agree to that premise. But then when and how you change is always a tactical question, because you don't want to be gratuitously provocative, but you don't want to let these guys off the hook either. And if they're running a dictatorship, at some point somebody has to say, you're running a dictatorship. And this, by the way, prior to the tear down this wall, was the evil empire speech, to say it's not just that we're providing greater material outcome and greater prosperity and allowing people to have better lives, but actually a top-down dictatorship like the Soviet Union is really harmful to humans and really does hurt human progress and experimentation and wish for a better life. And we're going to call him on that. So good for him. If there's no moral difference between what the Soviet Union is doing and what we're doing, if everybody's sort of the same and they're not an evil, then what's the Cold War all about? It's just kind of weird geopolitical competition with nobody's better than the other. And I said, then our complaint against Moscow is basically they're just clumsy or they're bad neighbors or something, but there's no real complaint. And I said, that we all know that wasn't the case. They invade countries, they subjugate populations, they lock up disciplines, they suppress religious freedoms. I mean, there's just a laundry list of problems in Moscow. So I'm glad Reagan elevated this issue.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me these important lessons, like friends are important internationally and in politics. I was struck by something else you said, that communications are part of leadership. They're essential to leadership. Moral courage is essential to leadership. What else struck you from Reagan, the person, that you took away as an important lesson?
Well, he was also a very modest man. He would never believe in grandiosity. He never believed in self-importance. He had a kind of self-effacing public demeanor. So it was never about him. He had a normal ego, I guess you could say, that he, you know, didn't thump his chest and say, I'm right and you're wrong and everybody knows this. He would avoid sort of self-serving superlatives about this is the greatest ever, the best ever. He was just comfortable enough in his own skin, secure enough in his own being. He said, it's not about me. It's about where is our country going? How can we improve the basis for more prosperity? And how can we improve the basis for American security? And what do we have to do to get there? So he's sort of the servant leader model of no grandiosity, no braggadocio.
Did you ever see Ronald Reagan angry?
What I thought was interesting, well, the short answer is no, he never really got angry. But I knew him well enough, Jeff, that I would say a storm cloud would cross his face But he was always a very controlled guy. The point is, look, the office of the presidency is not there so you can radiate your emotional response to things. All right, it's not. This is not your therapy session. It's just to be angry at somebody. The office of the presidency is there so you can help America go in the direction it needs to go. And anger is usually a pretty bad management tool. And it also, I think, betrays a limited maturity in the person who gets angry, right? It shows you don't have self-control. But it was always amusing to me. I could sort of tell myself when somebody was overreaching, overstating, or misstating, I said, this cannot be good news for the president. And he was very controlled. He never raised his voice. He never manifested anger. But you could see the sort of tightening of muscles that I would think is kind of amusing, because I said, I know this other fellow just stepped on Reagan's toes. I know that he just crossed a line. But Reagan's going to say, well, everybody sees this differently, and I'm not sure we agree with your point. That's a very gracious way to push back at somebody who just sort of gave you a slap. So, but he was a very good, I think, again, decades in Hollywood and public life lead you to this, because you know, Americans being Americans, you know somebody's running up to them saying, hey, your last movie was no good. Or I've written a better ending, and I don't know why they didn't use my ending. I don't know either, but Reagan's the actor, he's not the script writer. So, but you know, Americans are just uninhibited about sharing criticism to strangers. So you have to have a thick skin. You can't say, let's debate the movie ending. Please give me your thoughts, and I'll give you my response. You just have to say, thank you for your opinion, and glad you went and saw it. I hope you like the next one better. You just have to be gracious about it.
And maybe this is an unfair question, but you did see Ronald Reagan from the inside. You spent years with him. What was the most surprising thing to you about Ronald Reagan?
I think I've got to say this. Ronald Reagan, to my mind, had to be one of the most transparent personalities I ever worked with, meaning there's really no difference between his private persona and his public persona, his private philosophy of government and his public philosophy. When he said American economic growth will be better if we can restrain spending and we can lower taxes, that's what he'd say in every meeting with every congressional group, every outreach meeting, the public civic speech to the Rotary Club, or on his national radio address, he would make that same message. So there was no subterfuge with that man. He was a guileless individual. He had some clear, modest goals on what he wanted to do, and he knew how to present them, and he stuck to his strategy. And it was very admirable, to my view, that he didn't waver back and forth. Now, he could dial up or dial down certain attributes of that, meaning, as we were talking a minute ago, he did have a carrot and stick view toward the Soviets, but his view is always you better lead with some kind of a stick. Not that he's berating them or being mean to them, but that he's saying we need to speak from strength. We need to first build up our defenses, reinforce our alliances. Then we can sit down and ask what's on his mind. So, and how you dial that up and how you dial that down can be subjective, but it didn't change. His fundamental goal did not change about saying the Soviets are the bad guys here. They are the evil empire, and we need to find a way to put them under pressure, delegitimize their claim to governance, and make life more difficult for them.
Well, this is a fascinating look. To our listeners, let me again recommend this wonderful book by Ambassador Frank Lavin, Inside the Reagan White House.
May I hold up?
Please, yeah.
I just got my author's copy here, and I hope people enjoy it. I hope they like it. And you'll send me a note. I'm on LinkedIn or whatever. Send me a note if you've got a comment. I'd love to hear it.
You all are going to love the book. It's a terrific read and with great insights for leadership today. Ambassador Frank Lavin, thanks for joining us on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.